So as Lee said, I'm up here again for the first time since Christmas. And no, this won't be a repeat of that service. Obviously, it's something a little bit more serious. Not that Christmas isn't, but back then it was a little bit more, I guess, casual. But today I'm going to want you all to contribute to Psalm 127. And I'm not just going to stand up here and preach, even though that's why I'm up here. But, you know, we'll see where we go, and I certainly appreciate your contributions right throughout. Now, Lent is upon us Peter's got his own disclaimer, and I've got my own. It's not working for some reason. There we go. I could be right. Now, I don't know which is more dangerous. I could be wrong or I could be right. Do we have a quorum? I'm actually feeling more comfortable. There's not as many people here today. So, listen, I'm not a minister or a priest. And I don't profess to be. There's a lot said out there about Psalm 127. 2,000-3,000 years of history. I could only bring my insight and welcome you to share yours as well. Oh, right, there we go. Yeah. All right, what I'll show you, Lent is upon us with only 2 weeks, as Lee said, until Christmas, Easter, sorry, and with that I'd like to show this short clip.
The season of Lent is upon us. This is, of course, a time of abstinence, hopefully also a time of reflection. At times, Satan is the singer of a lurid song you hear on the radio. At times, the author of a salacious novel. At times, the quiet man lurking in the schoolyard, asking your children if he might join their game. And at times, the maker of sweet things, mere trifles, for what could seem more harmless, more innocent than chocolate.
Now, that really didn't have anything much to do with Psalm 127, but I always wanted to show that. Given my position here, I can see Peter, he's mouthing words right now to me. No, not at all. The man mouthing the words, in fact, is the town mayor. I don't know if you've seen the movie, but it's hilarious. It's very funny. Maybe it might be on TV in the next couple of weeks. But he's a town mayor, and it's a classic example how maybe politics shouldn't really mix with religion. And so maybe the next bit of this clip I might show later might have a little bit more relevance. We'll see. Now, let's see. All right, could be right. Here we go. All right, David. We've all heard of David. Now, part of what I'll do now is explain a little bit of a background to Psalm 127. It's quite a family or I guess a parent-oriented psalm, and I think most of you could bring something to the discussion, as I said. I will not be taking questions afterwards. I don't have all the answers, but I'm still very much learning about that whole process myself, about being a parent. Now, as I said, I'll talk a little bit about the background. Now, who can tell me, who was David? Who was David? Anything, just anything that pops in your head about David. What do you know about David? What, sorry? King of Israel. King of Israel, yep. Yep. Youngest, yes, yep. Good answers. And according to the Gospel of Matthew and Luke, he was also the ancestor of Jesus, an ancestor. So almost half the Psalms are in fact headed a Psalm of David, and with this there are several specific events in David's life. David had a son. What was his son's name? He had lots of sons, yes. This is Solomon, yes. He was in fact David's second son, and David promised him the kingdom. And Solomon took over as king of Israel after his father died in 970 BC. And so that was about 3,000 years ago, just to give context about the psalm. Solomon wrote three books of the Bible, the Song of Songs, Book of Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. Solomon, he had 700 wives. He had 300 mistresses. Now, I'm not sure where he found the time to write those books, but obviously he did. Now, our sages glorify King Solomon for his wisdom and great knowledge, but also mention that according to law, he committed three sins against God. Anyone know what any of those sins were? One of them, he married foreign women, sinner, had many horses, and owned lots of gold. Now, I just found it interesting reading about those sins, that having 300 mistresses wasn't actually one of them. this is a painting done by Edward Poynter in 1890. It's about the visit of the Queen of Sheba, and it's described in Kings and Chronicles. And there are a few renditions of this painting, in fact, throughout history, or this moment in history. And this one is the Judgment of Solomon. There are also a few renditions of this, and this was an example of Solomon's wisdom trying to resolve or solve an issue. I won't go into the details about that, but that one was here by Poussin in 1649. And that hangs up in the Musée du Louvre in Paris, France. All right, now let's get into the Psalms. And in terms of, it's believed that Psalm 127 was dedicated to Solomon by his father, David. However, some clues suggest that there were actually some of the components of that psalm actually written by Solomon himself. I won't go into the finer details of that, but if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer those later on, after the service, rather. it's known as a family psalm, and you may have seen some parts of this psalm written in some places, like people's living rooms on a piece of wood, or cafes, or t-shirts. Now, Psalm 127 reviews three areas of human endeavor: one, building one's house, so family or estate, etc. Keeping the security of a city or a town or a nation, and three, the creation of children. So let's look at the first one. All right. Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. Who here has actually built their own house? With their hands, or yes, with your hands, with your very own. Tell us about it, Karen. Yep. Oh dear. And with that, I jump ahead. I hope God was with you. Yes, good. Fantastic. Yep. Now, who's actually built their house, but not actually with their own hands, built a house from scratch with an architect and builders. Yes, John, tell us about that experience. And how did you find that experience, rewarding or stressful as well? Worked more. Yeah. That's another section of this psalm. We'll get to that. Anyone else want to? Yep, Ken.
The thing I remember very powerfully is the sweet feeling of seeing a well-poured foundation, seeing the footings going, and that slab. And you know that you can have lots of disasters, but that's the one you can't get wrong. And so it's the foundation being really important.
Yeah, foundations are important. In many things in life, of course. To build a house is really, in fact, probably the most interesting thing almost anyone could undertake to do. So one really should feel that their life is in God's hands while they're doing that, and that it depends on God whether this great undertaking in which he is engaged in is going to turn out well for him. He, having a house to build, a city to keep, and seed to raise up to his father, David directs Solomon to look up to God. Look up to God in that process. We often speak of Christ also having a house of God, or as the house of God. In the New Testament, we read of Christ as its foundation of the church being built upon him. In the New Testament, it also uses the term edification, meaning the act of building and of being built. So one of the things which Christianity doesn't like very much is laziness in general. If in a business I'm not diligent about things, I cannot expect to prosper. And so this is kind of an extension from the psalm. If I wish to be a man of learning, I cannot get it simply by praying for it. I must study, of course. If I make prayers to, general prayers about getting a driver's license, you cannot expect that God will give you that driver's license. You have to ensure that, do all the groundwork yourself, and then if things don't turn out the way you hope, then, you know, you make sure that, or you hope that God is with you through that difficult moment. If a person is sick, he must trust in God as much as he will. That should be his the first thing in the fact that you put the trust in God. The church of God is like a house of security and strength. We have never heard or read of Christians living anywhere without forming communities, families, or churches. Now, if you dissolve the family and society would perish, of course, then dissolve the church and Christianity would perish. The watchman stays awake in vain. Now, if we look at that section, think about that phrase. What might that mean, the watchman stays awake in vain? Does it mean the city needs a watchman?
The trust shouldn't be in the watchman, the trust should be in God.
Absolutely, yeah. Or that such a vital service should be discontinued? Not at all, but it's that we put our faith in God. It simply means that no amount of diligent concern can save a city without the blessing of God. Unless God shall bless our great towns and cities, the last one of them shall be destroyed. Yes, John? Oh, no, certainly not, no. But what God's saying here, I think, is you must trust that he looks over us, whether you have a watchman or not. So verse 1 here is, I guess, quite universal in its meaning. We've looked at a few aspects of that, including the dependence upon God and how it is vital to all human undertakings. In a simple term, it puts it that no matter how hard a man may work, if God's blessing is not upon him, then it will all be for nothing. I myself must add that I'm planning a transitional phase at the moment. A project to look forward to this year in 2015 and moving myself. I won't be going to the lengths of actually building my own house, but after doing some initial planning processes, I've realised the enormity of the whole project and the transition from, you know, selling your old house to buying a new one, and, you know, all the it has to be quite a, you know, a short, you have a short time frame which to do that with the lenders and the banks and everything, and it's quite a complicated process. So I certainly do seek God's strength in getting me through that process. So we'll see how we go. All right, let's have a look at the next one. It is in vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sleep. They say the best results of any thought or any effort of ours is in fact reached more in an unconscious state. Now, Sir Isaac Newton, he was lying underneath the apple tree in rest and in peace, and not quite asleep, but that apple fell from the tree and he had his revelation, and he gained that perception of the great law of gravity, of course. And you work as hard as you can, you rise early and sit up late, and you are doing all that you can in order that you may get bread to eat, and you do know that in all that work of yours you cannot do without God's help. So it's basically saying, from my interpretation, you need that time to rest. It's, you know, David or Solomon are saying through the words of God that it's important for you to not stay up late to try and basically, there are some examples here about how it says you are trying to gain too much wealth by working too hard, and that suggests that you should actually have that time for sleep to reflect on the day and to wake up and be refreshed and maybe in that time hear God's word. The brain, of course, becomes inactive during sleep, and consciousness is resting. And while the constructive forces dominate the destructive, dominate the destructive, it is a time of building up the system after the wear and tear of the day. Now, God is the great giver of the sleep. Who's had their own moments where they've gone to sleep and woke up with a bit of a revelation? All right, who'd like to share an example? Lindy?
Thank you.
So you woke up and your mind wasn't buzzing anymore. It was, things made sense. Almost like a eureka effect, I guess. Gail, do you want to share yours? Good. Anyone else want to share a time when they've woke up? Yep. Absolutely.
I have a turn off switch phrase, which is my only quote from the King James Bible, which is sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Good night.
That's a good one, yeah. No, absolutely. So don't underestimate the power of what God is doing to help us get through that night and have clarity. Did you, Thelma? No? You didn't. Okay. Who's heard of some of those musical composers who keep a pen or a pencil and a paper next to their bed? So when they wake up in the morning and they've had this revelation, they start writing down their inspiration. We do have great musicians here. We don't have philosophers. Yes, we have philosophers. We've got Peter Oliver here. Yes, yeah. Yet we all experience the same sort of thing. We don't have to be great musicians or philosophers. So, we have gone to bed, quite perplexed sometimes, as we've had some examples here today, and confused and committed ourselves and our thoughts to God, and we have risen in the morning to a clear perception and unquestioning resolution. It was in vain that we delayed taking rest to eat bread of carefulness. Now God has given to it. God has given it to His beloved in their sleep. Now I'll just read out a passage by W.K. Bryce, which is quite, I think, poignant. We could not live amid life's great anxieties unless God came to us night by night, breathed upon us the spirit of peace, and rocked us to sleep. As the mother rocks the tired child to rest, so does God, standing by the bedside of His beloved, and give them sleep. Now, there is also the sleep of security. Solomon slept with armed men around his bed, and that was his security, and he slept at night like that. But Solomon's father slept one night on the bare ground, not in the palace, with no moat around his castle wall, but he slept quiet and safely quite as safely as his son did with the guards around him. Now, what he said was, I laid me down and slept, and I awakened, for the Lord sustained me. So he was saying that the Lord looked after him while he slept. He didn't have to have the guards around him. He not only protects and refreshes us, but enlightens us. All right, let's moving on. Here's another slide I found. God provides for those he loves, even when they sleep. Another interpretation of that. I'm perhaps by no means a follower of this philosophy. I've got two jobs and I'm a full-time parent, so sleep is probably not something I get as much of as I probably should. I find often that if I go to bed earlier, even maybe about 11 o'clock, I'll remember my dreams in the morning, and maybe that's God telling me I need to get more sleep and I could reflect upon my day a little bit more effectively with God's help. Let's move on to the next one. All right, 127:3. Have a bit of a read. Now, verses 3 to 5 of Psalm 127 are quite closely linked, but we'll break them down a little bit further. To build a house in the Bible often means to bring up a family, and this one goes further to specify children. Now, in reference to children, Matthew 18 says, they are loved by God. Genesis 1:27 says, he has made them in his image. Psalm 139:13, he knew them before they were born and knit them together in their mother's womb. Jeremiah 29:11, he has a good and amazing plan for their lives. Now, we recognize, of course, the enormous influence that family has on a child. And it is, of course, our desire to be able to support families as they navigate the challenging and yet difficult, moments in life. But, of course, parenting is a very rewarding experience. It's interesting how they use the expression, the fruit of the womb is a reward. There's many different versions of that. But I think it's quite clear what that means. Now, they are to take our places, of course, the children. We must look after them, take care of them. They are going to be looking after us in our old age. They are to repair the losses caused by the removal of others. They assist, of course, for us to help get on with our lives as we might lose our parents as well, and to carry on and to carry further, of course, as noble citizens of our society, and carry on, I guess, in essence, our noble deeds and works, and not merely to replace us, but in fact to surpass us. W. Braden talks about it quite clearly. Let our influence be such as to nature in them to fervent love of what is right because it is right, and a profound loathing to all that is mean, selfish, double-minded, impure, unchristlike, and then will their minds respond with quick sensitiveness to all forms of goodness and turn with spontaneous hatred from that which is contrary to uprightness and truth. Most of us here, I think, are parents. Tell me some of your experiences about, I guess, the difficulties and rewarding moments, maybe positive rewarding moments, moments that have kind of enlightened you and, you know, I guess, in a way, made you realise that there's more to parenting than you realise. Anybody had some enlightening moments they want to share with us? Anyone? No? All right.
You just touched on such as so
No, that's
like,
that's true. And maybe if I gave you a week's notice to come here and give me something back, but if you should come up with something, then I'd be happy for you to share it. So, I experience that myself personally, almost on a daily basis. You know, with my son Josh, who's 11 now, and you know, I've obviously been a parent for 11 years, and it's you know, there's the joys of parenting obviously far outweigh any sort of, I guess, negatives that are associated with, you know, making sure the child is, you know, bathed or eaten or has eaten, or schooling, homework, all those sort of chores and routines. And but there's just so many positives to bring to that. And you know, that we look back at the Lord and how he has enabled that to happen for us. Anyone else can bring in a different sort of interpretation of this? It's pretty self-explanatory. Was that Trish? They get interesting, more challenging, yeah. Josh is on the cusp of that, so I might be taking a lot of good advice and prayers from God and yourselves. I went through that, yep. All right, number four.
Oh, yes.
So, how is an arrow like a child?
Do a lot of damage. They go straight to the point.
Well, that's the key. You try and ensure you know exactly where they're going, yes, but that doesn't always happen like that. An arrow is small but powerful. An arrow must be sharpened. A child must be educated, of course. Its mind to be developed. An arrow travels far. Who can measure the influence of a child? Its power depends upon the strength and judgment with which it is sent. Now, that's a lesson to parents, isn't it? And it's firmly embedded. And let us not, you know, we can, of course, make sure that we ensure that we look at the aspect of, well, I'll just read it. Let us not send into the world poisoned arrows, I guess is what I'm saying. So there are a few little analogies in terms of arrows and children that we can get out of that psalm, that section of the psalm. And as I said, number 3 to 5 are quite closely linked, yes?
Sorry, don't we stop another one here? An arrow achieves nothing at the stage of life.
Yep, absolutely. So if it stays in the quiver, then what? What are you saying, that you're keeping the arrow in the home or something? Keeping the children in the home?
I guess until it's launched, you can't achieve
anything. Hmm. Yeah, I like that. That's good. Yep. Yep.
I'm an archer, Rob. And unless you get the arrows properly balanced, they don't fly straight.
Hmm.
An arrow is just not a piece of equipment. You've got to get it, balance it, right point, right flight, right strength in your back.
Yep.
It's my children.
Yeah.
It strikes me also that it's the softest part of the arrow that is the most important part. Because the point of an arrow won't hit a target if the feathers aren't set.
Mm.
Right? Yeah. Like feathers, so, yeah. Quite often we look at the pointy end of things.
Mm. Yep. Yep.
And you need to know when to let go.
Hmm.
Yes. It's potentially wrong. I try to do it a bit slower than that, though.
True, very good. Yes, John?
I'm reminded of an old saying. People just don't mind about this.
All right. Now the next part of this one is... So what's that saying? Have as many children as you can? Yeah, I think there is actually, yeah. Yep. 12 in the bag. Now, Tim Hawkes, he's the author of a book called 10 Conversations You Must Have With Your Son, and Tim talks about this particular psalm. You're an archer. You are young, strong, and confident. You reach over your shoulder and extract a single arrow from your quiver. You crafted that arrow with care and packed that quiver yourself, so you know the shaft is straight and true, the feathered fletching precise. Still, you slide your fingers down the narrow cylinder in preparation for a flawless flight. You've spent many hours disciplining yourself, and so it feels natural to slide the notch of the arrow onto the bowstring. Combining strength and gentleness, you pull that arrow towards you, close to your heart. With great care, you choose a target that's exactly right for this exact arrow. You remain steadfast, feet planted firmly. With a slight smile, you let the beloved arrow fly. Your assignment as warrior is complete. So there's, yeah, comical interpretation there. You've got the children are the arrows, the bow is the godly training, and of course the target is God's plan. Anyone else want to bring some? Yes?
Is that ever
good? No, but you do try. You do try and try your best, yeah. Anyone else? Yes? No? Now, as we learn about our children, watching them learn, we learn more about our humanity, of course. We see them as rather, I guess, innocent, perhaps naive, and certainly fragile beings at a young age that we, of course, love very much and dearly and feel we need to, of course, look after. You may see this as a genetic thing, a species survival mechanism, but I see this as being built into us by God. It could be both, who knows. God tells us to guide them through the path he has set out for them, even though that path can sometimes be or become quite dark. We must show our children love, kindness, and of course tolerance. And that's what I more generally and broadly get from these Psalm 127. And it is, of course, up to us as parents and good people of this world to do the right thing and guided also by Psalm 127. Now I'm going to show you one last video. Of course, this is the mayor. Now, he's been quite indulgent during Lent, and as you can see, his face is full of chocolate.
I'm not sure. what the theme of my homily today ought to be? Do I want to speak of the miracle of our Lord's divine transformation? Not really, no. I don't want to talk about his divinity. I'd rather talk about his humanity. I mean, you know, how he lived his life here on earth. His kindness. His tolerance. Listen, here's what I think. I think we can't go around measuring our goodness by what we don't do. By what we deny ourselves. What we resist. And who we exclude. I think we've got to measure goodness by what we embrace. What we create. And who we include.
It was...
All right, thanks very much for your time, people. That was Psalm 127. Do we have a song to finish off there? Yep.